We held court in the land where gods and kings watched. Our hearts forged with metal and great lessons were taught. A great weapon was hoisted out the sky and it fell, cracking the ground beneath as the earth's belly had swelled. And a man, just a regular, ordinary citizen, daydreaming through life though he battled against the listlessness to see the world, cause inside him there grew a power that made its way from the gates to places new. Reading the sword and the stone, he knew the stories of his father, and he dreamed of bigger things though he rarely ever bothered. Till the day when he was face to face, a man in the mirror, fate's death hand was nearer as the plan became clearer. And any other day he might have passed that by, but any other day wouldn't have the will to try. But with that from inside, he reached out and took control of his life. Now the people all over the world know. Now I'm back to change the story, and I'm back to make it mine, and I'm back to switch the history given to me by the gods and the creators whose hands touched the divine. When my life was changed the day I first touched the mind, this is the retcon. The future's never gonna be the same, this is the retcon. The rewrite history again, this is the retcon.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 31. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from February 19th, 2014. Midas Flesh number 3 and Peter Panzerfaust number 17. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and this week on the couch, we talk with legendary artist Klaus Janson. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers from here on out.
Hello, comics therapist. This is Joe Patrick from the Two-Headed Nerd Comic Book Podcast, calling in with my answer for most impactful retcon. For me, it will always be Crisis on Infinite Earths, which I know some people consider a straight reboot. And if you'd like me to come on the show and explain the difference between a retcon and a reboot, I'm happy to take an entire hour to do so. But in reality, Crisis was both. Not only did it kind of reset a lot of characters from ground zero, it also streamlined decades worth of confusing history in such a way that it made things accessible without discarding the past. What they were left with was a DC universe where all the stories of the Justice Society on Earth 2 and all of the Captain Marvel stuff from whatever Earth he was from, they all happened in one universe. They all happened in the same history. It created an instant sense of legacy, though DC already had that. It kind of cemented DC as the universe where legacy and history were important. And it is absolutely an example of that sort of thing done right, as opposed to when they did it again in the New 52. That's a whole other nerd confession. But it's one of the things that made me a lifelong DC fan. And to this day, I think it is the most important retcon / reboot to happen in comics. That's my confession. I love you.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is retcons, comics therapy style. We're less concerned this time with changes to continuity. Hear that, Silva? And more interested in looking at two books that take characters from mythology and literature that we all know and love and then drop them down in an unexpected place and time. Reinterpretations are nothing new in comics or storytelling in general. Sometimes transporting a premise or a character from his or her origins breathes new insight into a stagnant tale you hadn't thought about in years. And sometimes it doesn't.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. Jason Sachs here at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Most impactful retcon? Are you serious? There can be only one. There can be only one. That is the one and only Alan Moore on the one and only Swamp Thing. Oh my God. He's a plant who thinks he's a person, not a person who thinks he's a plant. Oh my God. That's so fucking genius. That's it. That's awesome. Goodbye.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to weigh in on the most impactful retcon in comics. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience. The rest is up to you.
What's up, comic therapist? This is Corey Fryer at Corey Fryer on Twitter, and I'm sending in for this week's nerd confession about the most impactful retcon in comics. I'll admit, that the retcon that I am about to mention isn't all that impactful, as it is just utterly terrible. Of course, I'm referring to the introduction of Nick Fury Jr. Now, allow me to preface this negative rant by saying that I have absolutely no problem with trying to tie the Marvel comic universe in with the Marvel cinematic universe. I actually think it makes a lot of sense for new readers who may have been introduced to the characters via the film, but the way Nick Fury Jr. was introduced was by far one of the laziest and most asinine methods that could have ever been used. Marvel should be absolutely embarrassed that they wrote this out with a vote of confidence. I mean, I could go on and on and on about how poorly executed the whole Nick Fury Jr. debacle was handled, but I'd rather not open up any old wounds. I think Aaron knows what I'm talking about. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work. P.S. I'm totally on Team Space Merkin. Bye!
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and the show account, at Comics Therapy. So, Aaron, I'm sure that you want to tell us about all those comics you bought this week, and hooray, but I want to talk about the Lego movie.
Okay, you want to talk about movies I don't have time or resources to go see? That sounds fun.
Yep, pretty much.
Okay, go ahead. So just text message me when you're done and I'll come back.
Okay. It's awesome. I'm done. That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, okay.
It has a lot of flaws, and I hope that you get a chance to see it soon, and I think that Luke will definitely enjoy it. But on the whole, it's really cute and absolutely made me smile. And that's kind of the point of going to see movies, right?
Sure, for fun movies. I don't know. I don't think you always want to smile for all movies. The Blair Witch Project certainly didn't make me smile.
Right, because that's exactly what I'm saying. That's the point that I'm making here, is that all movies should make me smile, no exceptions, whatever.
You are a absolutist.
I'm not, really.
See? You're being absolute about that.
Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Have you...
It looks really fun.
Have you taken
I like
to
movies.
See a movie in a theater before?
No way. Are you kidding me?
Well... I mean, he's 3.5. Well,
yeah.
Right?
No.
No.
There are 3.5-year-olds who will sit through a movie, and then there's my son.
Okay.
Who will barely sit through, you know, a 15-minute TV show.
Okay.
So, I'm not really interested in wasting money trying to go to the theater with him right now.
Okay. I'm a little sad for you, because I think that it's a perfect father-son movie, but... I'm sure that it will be a perfect father-son movie in the comfort of your home, split up over multiple days.
Right. I mean, I would love to do that. It's just not realistic. There's just no way.
Okay.
He did sit through a 20-minute at the local like Children's Science Museum. He sat through, it's like a 20-minute kind of, what do you call those? You know, the projector on the inside dome kind of thing? You know, stargazing
planetarium?
Kind of thing. Oh, yeah, that's what it's called.
Uh-huh.
We barely made it through that. But that was a big win.
Okay.
Look, the kids these days, they're so distracted with their Nintendos and their Sega Genesis and their Walkman, you know. They don't have any attention span.
Okay. All of this is fine. I mean, I'm certainly not one to judge in terms of kids and media. We had to do an extensive media literacy course with Avi over the summer just to get him to watch a movie. But now I think we're pretty solid, and he had a great time.
Great, but he's also 5 years older than Luke.
This is true. I'm just saying it has been a long, hard road to get my son to the point where he can watch a movie.
Yeah.
And every kid is different. So, like, Luke's issue is not the same as Avi's, but I do sympathize.
Yeah, it's whatever. Oh, there's worse problems to have.
Sure. But I also, I definitely understand the desire to, like, share a media experience with, I mean, really anybody. I much prefer watching things with people who are getting kind of the same enjoyment or fulfillment out of it, and that shared experience is very integral to my own enjoyment. So when it's my child, then there's like a whole extra layer of sharing with him something that I enjoyed or something that we can enjoy simultaneously. So I get that. I know, and we've talked about this before, like you have to be patient, but sometimes it's really hard.
Yeah, I hate watching things with people.
Why?
Like that is totally foreign to me because I just want to watch it myself. I like the experience of watching it myself. Huh. I mean, you know, whatever. It's fine if people are going to be quiet and not interrupt the experience. That's fine. But I, more often than not, I would much rather watch something by myself than with someone else.
I just want to make it clear that I'm very capable of watching something and keeping my mouth shut.
I'm not going to take that risk.
I can go to a movie theater and not be that guy. In fact, I can do it in the privacy of my own home and watch something and not say a word. But
but then you're going to be tweeting or posting on Facebook or texting or something.
I mean, all of that stuff can go away. If the goal is complete immersion in the experience and if I'm with somebody who doesn't like want all of those distractions, or if I'm all by myself and I don't want all of those distractions, like I'm capable of that. You got a little judgy McJudgerson in your tone there, Myers. And I just wanted to make that clear.
I'm just saying I would rather watch it by myself than with someone else.
You don't enjoy the conversation and the discussion about like what you just saw or what's coming next, or like especially in a serial program where there's development of character and everything?
Nope.
Do you have a soul?
Yep. Well, I don't know. Actually, probably not. I'm sort of an agnostic on that kind of thing.
Okay.
But I don't know why we're having that discussion now.
Because I think that that's a lot about the sharing of the viewing is just as important as the viewing itself.
No, that's ridiculous.
Okay, not just as, but can be extremely...
I understand that humans like to get together and have experiences together, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's something I want.
Okay.
So stop trying to enforce your... weird homo sapien type standards upon me.
Because you're a soulless robot.
That's awfully judgy of you too. I don't like to put labels on myself.
You're the one who's getting all like anti-homo sapien, so.
No, I understand, like, you know, we read about what you animals like to do and how you have to gather in packs and
social,
you know,
creatures.
Right. But it's it's something intellectually I understand. It's just not something instinctually
okay.
I understand.
Well, put it this way. I have a very short list of people who I enjoy watching things with and a lot of people who I don't enjoy watching things with. And so that, I think, just lends a little bit of credence to what I'm saying, that it's about the complete experience, that it's not... like, not just fucking willy-nilly watching all the shows with all the strangers. That's not...
Sure. Well, okay. Let me backtrack. I will say, so if I wanted to go to a movie with Luke or I try to sit down with Luke and watch something, it's not so much about what we're watching. It is about the experience of watching it.
Sure.
But that means that I don't care about the content so much anymore. It's just the, you know, just that, just the human interaction.
But do you not think that there will be a point when he is older that the content is very relevant, and then that shared experience is about the two of you watching it and talking about it and like, oh, I don't know, then he quotes it incessantly for the next 4 days like Avi's been doing with the Lego movie?
I hope so. I just, you know, he's too young right now for me to see how that'll be. I mean, that'd be great.
Okay.
But... I don't know yet.
Well, all in due time, my friend.
I guess so. I just want to see Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. How super fun was that trailer?
That's a great trailer. I usually do not watch trailers too, but I gave in this time.
It was just cut really well. Like the
trailer, it didn't really give any spoilers, really.
But just the editing was like really solid, and the syncing with the music. Mm-hmm. The music itself, you know, take it or leave it. Definitely seen a lot of people complaining about the song. I don't care. I'm not weighing in on that. I just thought that moment as he's walking down the plank and the music and the beat and the, that was fucking tight. So yeah.
Sure.
Exciting.
Yeah. But usually for movies I know I'm going to see, I try to avoid kind of all media, you know, leading up to it.
I used to be like that. I'm not like that anymore.
Yeah. Well,
I have rediscovered how much I love movies. So I'm not, I have no shame in being like gleefully giddy about all of that.
Yeah, I think 3 or 4 times a year now I'll get to go to a movie myself. That's about what it works out to be. So it'll be like Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy. What else comes out this year? Avengers doesn't come out this year, does it?
Nope.
So I don't know. There's, you know, some, I guess, nice 2 wild cards. Probably not. Probably not. I didn't even get to see Thor, you know, in the theater.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I survived.
You did.
Mm-hmm.
You did. Weren't you?
I'm more interested in reading than talking about comics.
You were having a baby, like right in that minute that that movie came out, right?
I think it was like when Thor was out in the theater the first week was like Logan's due date.
Yeah.
I don't remember actually. Maybe.
I think you get a pass on that one.
Sure. I can still keep my nerd card.
Yeah, dude. Nobody is trying to take that away from you.
Good. Better not. Let's talk about some comics.
Okay. Are you going to do Inner Child this week or not?
Sure.
Are you going to follow the rules?
Yeah. I think we established there really aren't any rules anymore.
Okay. Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to talk about more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic. Maybe from the past week, maybe not. Surprise me. Sometimes it's not even a comic. Who cares? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Do you want me to time it? Because I feel like sometimes people are getting a little, speaking of Judgy McJudgerson, about the timer, too.
Oh, you mean the timer where at the end you blow their eardrums out?
So, audience is split on this.
I think it's safe to err on the side of the people whose ears hurt.
But
to the show that we're trying to get them to listen to?
I'm just saying I'm a little skeptical based on some of the people, one in particular, the only one in particular who said anything about it, who you happen to be married to.
That just means we have one person that listens to the show, and it's my wife.
Other people who do listen to the show have said it's not a problem.
Well, good.
Are you ready?
I don't think that's true. We heard from one other person who said it does blow his ears out.
Okay. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, go.
All right, so let's talk this week about Vampirella Monthly. Actually, Vampirella New Monthly, number 20 from Harris Comics.
Is this a new comic or an old comic?
I think it's like 1998, 99, something like that. Maybe it's later. But I bought it this week. It's new to me. I bought 2 copies of it, actually.
Why?
Because one has a cover by Bruce Timm. And then one doesn't, but the shop had both of them, and they were $1 each, so I just grabbed both of them. But the reason I bought it is because it has interior art by Bruce Timm, and I am a big Bruce Timm fan and have been trying to collect a lot of his issues that I don't have. So there's a lot of weird, random stuff that has, like, you know, 2 or 3 page stories from him that are really hard to find for one reason or another, or they're really expensive because people like Bruce Timm too. So like this issue was, I found 2 copies. One was $20 and one was $70.
What?
You know, on eBay. Yeah. Just because it's not, I don't think there were a ton of them printed, and you know, Vampirella, I don't think is a highly pulled comic, so there's not a lot of issues of it floating out there.
So what are you going to do with this?
I read it and now I own it.
And so now it's in plastic.
It's in plastic.
Huh.
But, yeah.
I don't know how I feel about this, but it doesn't matter because your time is up.
You don't know how I feel about owning a comic? I have news for you. I've owned 23,000 of them.
I don't know how I feel about this particular, not this particular book in terms of like content or creator or anything, but so now you have 2 copies. You spent about $100.
No, I spent $2.
Wait, you said 70 and 20.
are what I found online. And then I asked my local shop if they had it, and they had two copies of it.
Oh, well then
and they just sold it to me for a buck.
I retract all previous statements.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't going to spend $100 on it.
But you understand why I was confused, and you understand why I would be. Maybe the theme of this week is Judgy McJudgerson.
No kidding.
Sorry.
I mean, if there was a reason like that was worth that much across the board and consistently sold for that much, then I couldn't find it anywhere else, then maybe I'd be tempted to, because I could probably resell it for that much too.
Is that what you're
going to
do?
No. I wanted to own it.
Okay.
But I don't want to buy a book for more than I think I could ever resell it for.
And $2 is definitely within that threshold.
Yes.
Well done.
Yeah, that was fine. Okay. Anyway, you want to talk about new books?
Yes.
All right. Let's do that.
Greetings, comic therapists. Roderick Ruth here, at Roderick Ruth on Twitter. And this is my nerd confession on the best. The most impactful retcon in comics. For me, it's Madeline Pryor. Sure, I could blame Chris Claremont for creating her as a way to pacify Scott Summers and that they could ride off into the sunset together. Or I could blame the Marvel editors for attempting to literally resurrect the original X-Men team under X-Factor. But sadly for me, I love X-Factor and Chris Claremont too much to do so. If there could be a personification of a comic book retcon, old Maddie Pryor is it. Not only does the clone of Jean Grey convolute the Dark Phoenix saga and steal Cyclops away to Alaska, but she also bears his child, Nathan Summers. But is this kid born as a healthy mutant messiah? Nope. He gets burned by the techno-organic virus and catapulted into the future, later becoming the character known as Cable. Not only that, but as soon as Marvel resurrected a dead Jean Grey, Scott leaves her in the dust to lament and later become the Black Queen, or the Goblin Queen, or the Red Queen, or some other stupid redundant villain. Oh, did I mention she hits on Cyclops' brother Havok and tries to recruit him as the Goblin Prince? Not only that, but her murky origins of being a genetic clone created by Mr. Sinister and then being used by Mastermind didn't really get properly fleshed out until much, much later in the character's existence. This character has been metaphorically thrown around like a game of hot potato in the mutant universe and just destroying everything she touches. That's my confession. Catharsis is still cool. Thanks, guys.
Our first book this week is Midas Flesh number 3, written by Ryan North with art by Brandon Lamb and Shelley Paralini? I don't know how you say that. Paraline, right?
I don't know.
I think that's about right, and I'm very sorry. The Midas Flesh is published by Boom Studios.
So, keeping with the actual theme of the week, this book is a re-examination of the myth of King Midas, which, if you're not familiar, is the story of a relatively greedy man who asked for everything to be turned into gold whenever he touched it. He has a slightly different personality in the flashbacks of this story. He's rewarded with that gift, if you can call it that. And the weaponization is what is the hook for this particular story. But it is, in fact, very much reliant on the mythology of this. Everything that your flesh comes in touch with is rendered in gold.
Yeah.
So there's no way for me to talk about this book without actually talking more about Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. Are you familiar with it?
I am familiar with both the title and the writer.
But the book itself?
Yes.
Okay. So,
but to be fair, I read it 20 years ago and I didn't refresh my memory on it at all.
Well, so I read it probably 20 years ago as well, but I think that it's the Vonnegut book more than any others that has really stuck with me. And there are a couple of reasons. There are a couple of like themes that he introduces in the context of the weird religion that the narrator comes across in the story. This idea of like groups of people who are linked together because of a significant event and so on and so forth. So there's like all of this weird Vonnegut vocabulary. But the crux of the story, and this is a giant spoiler, but I don't know, if you guys went to English class in high school, you've probably read this book. The weaponization of the element. Can I call it an element? It's probably not an actual element. Of this substance, Ice Nine, in Cat's Cradle is almost identical to what happens to the gold when it basically kills the planet Earth when Midas wishes that everything he touches turns to gold. It's a it's a more lengthy and kind of painful process. But essentially, Ice Nine is like water rendered solid at room temperature. Mm-hmm. And so when it touches the ocean in the book, it's like, whoo, the entire planet basically dies. And then there's like pockets of people here and there who are aware of it, the narrator being one of them. And so his eventual demise is like a little bit more tragic, I guess. But that was such a strong image for me, and one that I couldn't then read this, even knowing that it's more tied to the Greek myth. For me, the connection was much stronger to Cat's Cradle than anything else.
And it's funny because like this is not a kid's book. I would say it's a young adult comic.
Yeah, sure.
But Cat's Cradle is far more intense.
Well, yeah.
Totally. You know, I mean, but yeah, you can definitely draw similarities there. And with this third issue, I think we're getting that glimpse of once you unlock, you know, to go to more Greek myths, you know, the Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. Like,
certainly.
Once that gets off Earth and gets into the universe, what happens?
Well, I think that that's really exciting, though, because that's something that I always, like, I always thought about what happens after Cat's Cradle ends. It has a convention in terms of narration that is also really appealing to me, like The Plague by Camus. The narrator and the character are kind of one and the same, and it's only revealed at the end that they've been telling the story all along. But then it just ends. And so this idea in Midas Flesh, where we find out what happens afterwards, and obviously the Earth being encrusted in gold is not part of the original Greek myth, but like what happens after the planet dies is something that has always really been intriguing to me in terms of the Ice Nine disaster. And so I'm like really into this now with this comic, because I think that it's a story that I relate to, you know, for 20 years of supposition. I'm like excited to see what's going to happen now, taking it outside of like the Earth's context.
See, you know, for someone who claims not to like disasters or like end of the world stuff, you have quite an affinity for it.
I feel like I modified my claim relatively recently that...
Sure, but now we're finding out that this is the big retcon for you, I guess. Like, we're finding out you've been obsessed with this for years.
I have been. I was open about it. That doesn't mean that I'm not afraid of it. It's just that I'm trying very much to face my fear and like fucking embrace it and acknowledge that the fear and the like, you know, pain and pleasure go hand in hand. And I'm not turning this into anything about sex, Meyer, so don't go there. But there's a part where the thrill and the fear is enjoyment in and of itself.
Sure.
That's all.
As long as you leave with a smile.
Well, maybe not in every single movie, but certainly in the Lego movie.
I was making a sex reference.
Well played.
You want to talk about our next book?
Moving on.
This is Captain Cummings, and my favorite retcon in comics is the death of Captain America. It was long and drawn out, but it was really a masterpiece when you see... the unlikely person to take over Captain America from Steve Rogers, the spoiler, Bucky. Anyways, and the reason that it's very special to me is I remember being in the Navy, and, you know, I liked reading comic books when I was younger, in high school and before that, you know, mostly X-Men, 90s X-Men. But I was in the Navy store, and looked over, and there was a copy of the Navy Times, just a regular Navy newspaper. And they had the death of Captain America, and they had, you know, they showed him in his casket. They were pallbearers were taking him there, and I was just like, wow, that was incredible. It took me 5 years to read that book because I'd never liked buying anything and then having to carry it around the boat and stuff like that, but it drew me in. So there you go, and love you guys. Bye.
Our second book is Peter Panzerfaust number 17, written by Curtis Wiebe with art by Tyler Jenkins. Peter Panzerfaust is published by Image Comics.
Okay, so this one is a retelling of Peter Pan, set in World War II. Set primarily in France. Peter is American, which I think is an interesting take on that character. Some of the boys are French and some are English. And I believe he's the only American.
I believe you are correct.
So that's significant, sure. And it's a kind of wonderful allegory with, obviously, Hook being of the Nazi persuasion. And Peter and the boys are working with a group of the French Resistance. And that's where we get the character of Tiger Lily as well, although it's mostly just Lily. And her group is a more official part of the French Resistance. Obviously, in the original novel, we have Peter and his lost boys, and then the Indians, of which Tiger Lily is part. And Wendy Darling and her brothers, Michael and John, who were English in the original book, are also English in this. And a little bit older. In fact, almost everybody is a little bit older than I would typically say is generally the way that Peter is rendered. But it obviously makes sense.
By 10 years at least.
No. Peter's like 16 or 17 in this. And I think in Peter Pan, he's typically portrayed as about 14 or so.
Oh, really? I always figure him like, I don't know, like 9 or 10.
No, you need to read your source material, dude.
I don't read.
Well. That's a problem.
Yeah, not so far.
So anyway, I wasn't reading this. I have been encouraged to read it by any number of people who I trust their opinion of both books and what I like, but I just hadn't gotten around to it. But when I saw that it was on the list for this week, I was really into it. I wanted to build our conversation around me finally sitting down and reading this, and it did not disappoint me, because I think this, the theme of this week in terms of literature and mythology in comics and revisiting stories and kind of like not quite retconning, it's not at all, but it works for the song. looking at things from history or things from mythology or things from literature and transferring them into a different time for storytelling is something that we do a lot in theater, and so it's exciting when it works in a comic.
Yeah, and I think this one especially has worked very well, because I think when you're doing these adaptations, it's important not to try to shoehorn a different scenario or place and time, that sort of thing, into the original beats of the original story, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Like, this is Peter Pan very loosely. It's with aspects you will recognize, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to stay like so, adhered to it.
Absolutely. I mean, the current arc is going way far into left field from the more classic Peter tales, and that's fine. In fact, it's reestablishing the characters in their own right, and that's fantastic. It like gives more legitimacy to the story, like on its own legs.
I like that too. Yeah, that it's slowly kind of evolved and broken away from that closer mold, so that the characters are recognizable in that they are these allegories or whatever, these new manifestations, mm-hmm. but they are taking on lives very separate from the original stories, right. as well.
But there are very true character traits that are essential for this story, because like Peter is such an iconic character and yeah. has been translated to other media already, like in so many other forms. And there's like a whole mythology of Peter's story and the, you know, and Barry's story of writing Peter. And so I think that actually gives the creators of this book a lot more freedom. I mean, almost on par with playing around with King Midas, because like no one's going to come after you for changing that particular story. It's thousands yeah. of years old. This one is just like so similarly ingrained in our like Western literature that you can have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, well, and then you also have the backdrop of World War II, certainly. Which you have unlimited stories and myths and, you know, everything as time has gone on, because it's such a important part of our history, and it's still fairly recent too, I would say, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know what else to say about that other than I really like it. I really enjoy it, and I enjoy it not in spite of, you know, what it's a take upon, but that it's its own story. Like, I think it's just really well written and really well done.
So I guess I have a question for both of these books, that if you don't know the story that they are referencing, and I think that that's an academic exercise, because I think it would actually be, it's probably harder to find somebody who doesn't know Peter Pan than King Midas, yeah. but...
Yes.
But, like, does that matter?
I don't think so. And I think that's the hallmark of a good story like this, that it can stand on its own.
Okay. I think I agree.
Right? That it's like, that it's fun if you know what it's kind of referencing or basing itself on.
Sure.
But it shouldn't need to have that as a prerequisite.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like either of these do.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, they're just compelling stories that are good reads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what every book should do.
Sure.
And
sure.
you should leave with a smile on your face.
Are we talking about sex, or are we talking about the Lego movie?
Yes.
Oh, that is a sentence that should probably never be uttered again.
Well, you said it.
I did.
I'm glad you, not me.
Right.
So, man, now I was digging for a transition, but there's just zero.
There's no transition at all. And as usual, I am kind of leaving you hanging to make a fool of yourself.
You're like screwing me week after week on this. We did well for a little while.
No.
And then you just have been, I think I did pretty well.
No.
Okay. So then I'm going to continue my run of terrible transitions and say we have a wonderful interview with Klaus Janson for you to enjoy. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah, this is a fantastic interview. And there's no attempt to package it as anything other than just like a really great conversation with a really amazing, legendary creator.
Hi, guys. Retcons, retcons, retcons. My worst in recent memory has to be the introduction of the Wildstorm characters to the new 52. These hollow versions of once great characters are a disgrace to their Wildstorm namesakes. These books were a mess from the start, and it is evident that DC has given up trying to even keep these characters in the N52 with the cancellation of Stormwatch. There are no books with Wildstorm characters on the shelves. DC tried to shoehorn these books into their universe when they clearly don't fit in here. It may have been a better idea to integrate some of the Wildstorm characters to establish teams and go from there, but a meager fan, Mike Lefine at Lefine Is Me, love the show, you guys. Thanks.
Hello?
Hello?
Yep.
Oh, good. You can hear us.
Yeah.
Well, technology, you never know. This is Aaron. And
Aaron, hi. How are you?
And this is Andrea.
Is that Andrea in there?
Yes. Hello.
Okay. How are you, Andrea?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. Just sitting here waiting patiently for you to call.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah. Sorry,
honored.
We kept you waiting for a minute and a half.
That's right. That's right. A whole minute and a half. I could have penciled a page in that time.
Oh, wow.
I'm kidding. I am kidding. Believe me. If that were true, I'd be, you know, stinking rich.
I sent you questions this morning. Did you have a chance to look at them?
Yes, I did. Yeah, they're right here, as a matter of fact.
Any concerns or thoughts about them? Anything that you're not comfortable talking about?
No, not at all.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And will you say your last name for me so that I don't mess it up?
It's Jansen.
Okay.
Yeah.
We had a little conversation about how Americanized it was, and I was wrong, so good.
Sorry, Andrea.
No,
it's Jansen in America. In Europe, it's, you know, they pronounce it differently. It's Jansen,
right.
You know, with a Y. So as long as we're in America, we'll, you know, we'll do what Americans do.
Sounds like a good plan.
Sure. Aren't you surprised I don't have an accent?
No, because I did the math and you were really young when you came here, so.
Very good. That's right.
Well, I wasn't sure though, because like we, you know, I didn't dive too deep into the internet, but you know, some, it could have been that you came here early as a child, but I don't know if you went back, you know, your parents went back to Germany or something when you were younger, and it could have been the kind of thing where you spent split time or something, so.
Well, that's true. No, but we got here and we stayed here, and there was the only time my accent ever comes out is if I have a beer.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Not even then. No.
Do you still speak German?
A little bit. I'm going to a convention in Erlangen, which is a town 50 miles from where I was born, and I'm brushing up on my German because I figure, well, you know, I still have some aunts and uncles there and cousins, of course, so I'll visit. It's sort of my homecoming victory parade in a way.
Oh, well, that's even more excellent.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they don't think of it that way, but, you know. But I'm going to force that concept onto them. So
everybody
the hell
should
with them.
Have that at least once in their lives.
Well, pardon me, Aaron, go.
Oh, have you been back before? Is this your first time?
I was there in 68 with my mom and my sibs, but... I'm the oldest in my family, so when we went back, I was just a babysitter really for, you know, all my brothers and sister who were, you know, younger than me. So
since 68, I mean, Germany's changed quite a bit.
I know, yes. And so have I.
That's right.
Have you guys ever been to Europe or?
No, my family, some of my family is from Germany as well. But I have never been there. I've never been overseas anywhere.
No, I've never been to Europe. I've been to Israel. I did the Hillel birthright trip in college. So it was like an all expenses paid trip to, you know, to Israel for kids. So that's about as far as I've been outside the country, but never to Europe yet.
I would recommend it. It's really, I've traveled a bit, so it's fascinating. An ex-student of mine just opened up just about 3 months ago, opened up a comic book shop in Tel Aviv.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
I think it's the second one in Tel Aviv, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm desperately trying to get him to figure out a way so I can visit.
That's kind of surprising that there's only a second, because it's such a international city. You know, people come from everywhere, and especially Europeans.
That's right.
It's kind of surprising that there wouldn't be more of a comics influence in Israel.
There are certain countries, I mean, and actually Germany was one of them until very recently, where comics just did not seem to take a really strong foothold.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the reason why he opened up a comic book store was he was just having difficulty making a living as a illustrator or a comic book artist.
Hmm.
So there is, you know, there are definitely some countries where comics are a little bit ahead of other countries, you know, like France, of course.
France, right. And it seems like Australia has a big, comics community.
Right.
You know, Great Britain and everything does too. You know, but you hear that more and more about like Germany and those areas, and things are getting translated into German a lot more too. So It's making an influence.
Right. It has taken off, which, you know, I'm happy to hear. You know, why should any country be immune to, you know, this wonderful medium?
It's true. Right. But comparatively, I mean, the European, just the way comics and like illustrated, you know, graphic novels and that sort of thing, it's a much different kind of culture, it seems like. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I find kind of fascinating, because we're not really, we don't get a ton of influence here in the U.S. of a lot of European stuff. You know, it's kind of trickling over, but so much stuff doesn't get translated, and it's such a different kind of process too about how they're created and how people approach, you know, a work and how long it takes and that sort of thing. So it's kind of one of those things I find pretty fascinating.
Yeah, we've had some great conversations with creators who have a particular affinity for the European comics, who either found them when they were younger or stumbled on them when they were developing themselves as artists. And so it seems like those individuals who found them have really, many have really like latched onto it because it feels so different. Maybe it feels fresh, or maybe it just feels like an extension of the medium that they're working in. And so it's always really interesting to hear people's, you know, thoughts on the various approaches to comics worldwide.
I think what you're saying is true. And I think what's really interesting in America, what's happening in America, is that I would draw a parallel to the European comics and the American indie market, or the American indie publishing scene, which is very, very surprisingly prolific and deep. And a lot of people aren't really aware, you know, those of us who are just reading mainstream comics are really not aware of what's happening in on this continent. As a matter of fact, I include Canada, you know, in that. But the indie scene is amazingly popular, I think, and getting larger. And it needs to be discovered in the same way that European comics need to be discovered, you know, by mainstream Americans, I think.
Yeah, it's hard. I live in Eugene, Oregon, so I'm a couple hours south of Portland. Mm-hmm. And Portland is such a hotbed for independent comics that you kind of lose a little bit of sight of how they're not really known or available in most of the rest of the country. You know, it seems like it's a East Coast or West Coast kind of availability, and then the rest, it gets a trickle of that, but they're definitely, you know, there's maybe Austin is another kind of enclave for that, but you know, there's not a ton of market support elsewhere.
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, like anything, it needs promotion and advertisement and you know, or you know, something to make it stand out. And a lot of the indie publishers don't have the money and resources for that,
mm-hmm.
But it's there, you know, and I kind of feel like it's our responsibility to not only discover it but support it.
What's your feeling of like of Image Comics? Like, we were just at Image Expo, I guess about a month ago now, and that was a pretty big deal. It got a lot of, you know, press coverage. Like, Image is is very big. You know, they're being compared to, like, they're the third, you know, big publisher now, even though it's all creator-owned independent comics.
Well, Image certainly, I mean, there's been a couple of things that really changed, I think, the medium and the market. I mean, Image was one of them. Kickstarter, you know, and crowdsourcing in general was another that really changed the medium. But, you know, Image is, I wouldn't consider Image indie.
I wouldn't either.
Right.
It's interesting to hear you say that.
Who would consider them indie? I mean, do you know anybody that does?
They do, I think.
They do.
Yeah. I think that they are very proud of that.
They may be... go ahead, Andrea. Go ahead.
I just think that, at least for me, and maybe this is just about semantics, but indie to me is not any of the publishing houses that we're probably all thinking of. Certainly it's not Marvel and DC, but it's not Image. It's not Dark Horse. It's not any of the kind of top Dynamite, even it's much, much smaller and therefore exclusive in a way that is more a product of distribution than anything else. It's not a kind of weird entitlement thing about we want to stay separate, although I certainly have met creators who have that philosophy. But I think more so when I use that term, it's a product of content as well as access. And I just don't think that when you're speaking of something that is distributed on a national level, that you can seriously still talk about it the same way that you would small press books.
Yeah, I think you're completely correct. And, you know, when I think of indie, I think of, you know, Michael DeForge or
Box Brown or something.
Yeah, Michael Fife, who does Copra, you know, people who are literally self-publishing things and don't have the backing of a major company behind them. And Image is, you know, 10% of the market now. And even with less than that, I would consider them to be a major publisher. I mean, they, you know, there's an organization, there's, you know, money, there's, you know, people running it, you know, Michael DeForge and Michael Fife, guys like that don't have the backing of, you know, a company to support them. They're, you know, they're eating out of, you know, they're eating, you know, hot dogs and beans, I would imagine.
But that's why I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with Copra or with anything else that he does that's creator owned now that he's writing for Marvel, because that's a, it's a big leap in terms of business philosophy from where he has been to the potential place that he's going. And I think, like, I am really interested to see what, if anything, changes with his own work that he's still producing himself.
I agree. It's a fascinating, you know, turn of events for Michael Fife to be, you know, writing up at Marvel. You know, and more power to him. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, why he shouldn't. And, you know, it was I was fascinated by even Trad Moore doing Ghost Rider up at Marvel. And I think that, you know, what he was doing at Luther Strode at, it was Image, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was Image, right. You know, was terrific work, but you know, there still is something to be said. Even, you know, the jump for Michael Fife to Marvel is a bigger leap than, you know, from for Trad Moore from Image to Marvel. But nonetheless, once you get to Marvel or once you get to DC, they still are the two companies that are the biggest publishers in the business, and you start to assume all of the stuff that comes with that move, you know, the good stuff and the bad stuff, you know, the blessings and the notoriety and the publicity and the diminishment of your own creative powers.
I think if you look at, well, like, I think Sam Humphries is probably a good example of that, like, who was doing his own self-published books for, you know, years.
Right.
And now he's a pretty big writer at Marvel, and you've definitely seen quite a bit less output of his personal work since he's been doing that. You know, so it definitely seems to shift the creative. Maybe it's just your time too. You know, it's like, this is a steady paycheck. I'm not having to hope I can make, you know, rent every month.
Listen, you know, you're able to make a living at Marvel in DC, you know, and it's, you know, call me crazy, but you get seduced by, you know, being able to eat three meals a day. And, you know, it's okay. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Stability is nothing to be ashamed of.
No, not at all. No.
So I want, can we, let's back up for a second, because this is awesome, but I don't want to totally lose momentum. But let me do a quick intro, and then I'm going to cut the hell out of this altogether so that we can capture some of this for our listeners. And let me do our intro and we'll circle back with some of the questions. But if we go off script, like, that's fine. We just really enjoy talking, so.
it's fine, you know, the we'll just talk about whatever you want.
Awesome.
Or whatever comes up.
Yes. Okay. We'll talk about whatever you want to.
Sure, go right ahead.
This week on The Couch, we are honored to welcome legendary artist Klaus Janson. Mr. Janson has been a prominent penciler and inker for Marvel and DC Comics for over 40 years. He worked with Frank Miller on Daredevil in the 1970s and collaborated with Miller again on The Dark Knight Returns a decade later. Mr. Janson has taught at the School of Visual Arts in New York City since the 1990s. Recently, DC announced that he would join John Romita Jr. on the upcoming Geoff Johns Superman run. Thank you so much for taking time out to talk with us.
Sure. Thanks, guys. it's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess let's maybe just start at the start, even though we kind of touched on this a little bit prior to that intro. But so the early part of your life, so you're born in Germany. We talked about that a little bit. And then you immigrated to the U.S. When you were very young. Was drawing something you remember being a part of your life early on growing up? Like, where were your influences with comics and art and that sort of thing? What are your earliest memories of that?
You know, the myth of, you know, my upbringing is that my father, whom I've never met, was an artist. Hmm. And so we had, I had some sort of a, you know, psychological, emotional affinity toward that, just to, you know, sort of, not to get too psychologically, you know, deep, but the connection to a lost parent, you know, was there. And I think that I always remember drawing, even if it was, you know, with crayons as a really little kid, even in Germany. But, you know, when we got here, I was about 4.5, 5. And it was that summer, I think we got here in June, and it was that summer that I discovered comics. There was literally a classic five and dime store about a block from my house. And, you know, they would sell cigars and candy, and they had a rack of comics. And the first comics that I looked at, you know, back in, you know, this was the late 50s, was the Mort Weisinger DC Superman stuff. Mm. And what I would do is, actually I learned how to, you know, and this is part of the Klaus myth. I learned how the mythology, you know, of KJ. But I learned how to read and write through reading comics and looking at the pictures and doping out what the words were and trying to figure out, you know, the language. And that experience really profoundly affected me because I was, I think even at that early age, I certainly looking back on it now, I realized that I was affected by the power of the image, I think more so than had I been born in, you know, the United States and learned English through, you know, the usual, you know, mom and dad options. Mm-hmm. By looking at the image, I was able to discern what the story was. And that is what I teach at SVA is, mm-hmm. is, storytelling without words, you know, the ability of an image to communicate. What I did, you know, when I was about 5 or 6, after I discovered these comics, I started to cut apart the comics themselves, the figures or the panels, and then reposition them on a sheet of paper, you know, scotch tape them, and make up my own stories.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know. Yes, it was. Why I have no idea, but I, you know, distinctly remember sitting at, you know, the kitchen table and cutting apart, you know, these Superman comics or these Lois Lane comics, whatever, and just, you know, making up my own stories. But I realized at a certain point that I was, you know, destroying the comics themselves. So I had no actual, you know, copies left. And I started to draw. So I started to draw them rather than cut apart and, you know, reposition, you know, the figures into doing, you know, whatever I wanted them to do. And that's really how it started, you know. And you know, it was sort of like this pseudo identification with my long lost father, and also to preserve, you know, the comics that I was buying. So I started drawing, and honestly, I never stopped. I just haven't stopped. I've been drawing really since, you know, I was about six, you know, and drawing comics. Mm-hmm. I just never stopped. You know, nobody told me to stop.
Right. Did those so were those early, like the Superman stories, you know, the superhero golden age stuff, was that a big influence on your perception of the US and the American culture too? Like, was that part of that sort of immersion into American life?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. But I would even take it a little bit further than that. I think that, you know, in thinking back on that and sort of analyzing it from a distance, I think that those books sort of communicated to me what was a sense of morality, mm-hmm. you know, what was right and what was wrong. And I learned a lot from that. You know, it was highly influential. Not the only influence in my life, of course, but I learned a lot about the culture. And you know, once you get to this country, you have to understand that. You know, when we left Germany, it was still very, very much suffering from know the effects of World War II. And, you know, coming here, I mean, the things that I remember discovering were comics, television, you know, which we did not have, mm-hmm. and orange soda, you know, which we also didn't have. You know?
Right. There's while America was prospering, you know, Germany was
sure.
suffering, a crushing
right.
depression. Yeah.
Well, and that's why my parents left, was because of the economics of it. But to me, those were the, you know, that was the triumvirate, you know, orange soda, comics, and television. I mean, there wasn't really anything else I needed at that point. You know,
I feel pretty similarly now. Yeah. I agree.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
That is right.
The needs haven't changed. Yeah, it stays the same.
Well, so we've talked about the proximity to the industry being an important part of the development of a lot of creators. So especially when you consider how relatively recently you had to be very close to your collaborators, that burden has been lessened by digital accessibility, but you grew up in Connecticut, so you're fairly close to the city where Marvel and DC were based. And I'm interested very much in hearing about the vibe of working at that point. What was it like living and working in that hub of activity in the 70s and 80s, especially because it is so different now. And it's something that, I mean, Aaron and I are both in our mid-30s, and we can't necessarily relate. Well, we certainly can't relate to working within the industry, but we can't necessarily relate to this idea of physically being attached to your workplace in the same way that it was so essential at that time when you got involved working in the comics industry.
It's a difficult thing to describe without having hours to talk about it. For me, living in Connecticut, I mean, we got all the New York television stations, you know, mm-hmm. The local TV news and the, you know, those sad little Saturday, Sunday morning TV shows that the local TV, you know, would put on. Chuck McCann and Officer Joe Bolton, you know, all these, you know, they'd show cartoons and stuff. And for me, New York always was Oz. I needed to be in New York. I wanted to be there. I wanted to get out of Connecticut. Nothing against Connecticut, but to me, this was always the golden city on the hill, and it was where it was happening. You know, John Lennon, you know, said before he was killed, obviously, that New York is Rome. You know, a Rome of today, and there is that sort of magnetic pull that a place like New York has to those of us who were, you know, raised in the suburbs. And getting here, you know, like I, in the early 70s, moving here finally and meeting, you know, Neil Adams and Dick Giordano was my mentor. He lived in Connecticut in the town near, next to mine. So I had gotten to know him a little bit and, you know, meeting these people that were so influential on my work, you know, just through the comics that they produced. And becoming part of that community, you know, hanging out at the office at Marvel or hanging mm-hmm. out at DC and seeing, you know, the day-to-day operation was very, very different than it is now.
Right.
These days, DC and Marvel is not dissimilar to, say, working at Sports Illustrated, you know, a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's clean, it's professional, it's, you know, the offices are cubicles and, you know, everybody's well-behaved. You know, back then it was a zoo and it was, you know, it was flying by the seat of your pants. And I'd often get work just because I was the nearest warm body. Mm-hmm. And things like that don't happen as much anymore. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that, you know, being at the stage that I was at when I broke into comics, I could not get work today with that portfolio. And I think, you know, justifiably so.
So was it just a product of proximity then, or just the energy of being in the right place at the right time?
I think it was a combination of all of that and, you know, luck and, there was something about it that was not corporate yet. It hadn't been okay. corporatized, and I think that's probably a good way to describe it.
Sure.
It was more of a, it had more of an indie flavor to it. You know, nobody really had any idea that, you know, let's put out a comic and make a movie out of it next year.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was purely, you know, there were no royalties, for instance. You know, my first page rate was, for inking, was $40 a page. And that wasn't that bad at that time, you know. I mean, you couldn't conceivably live on that now. Yeah. So, you know, you really went into it for the love of the medium, and I'm not in any way disparaging anyone's affection for the medium today, but it's a different formula to break in. You know, you couldn't break in today without social media, mm-hmm. or having a presence on social media.
Right.
And you could easily break into comics and still be a hermit, you know, back in the 70s or 80s. You know, you didn't need to necessarily network, although, you know, that never hurts. But it was when I used to talk to Dick Giordano about, you know, his era. You know, we all have our own eras, and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's eras, E-R-A-S, not E-R-R-O-R-S. But I always associate, say, Dick and a lot of those guys, you know, Frank Giacoya and people that I had met, you know, along the way who worked in the 50s, as a period of time when men wore hats. You know, it was the Mad Men period.
Mm.
And, you know, my era was kind of, you know, when we were, you know, post-hippies almost. You know, we all had, you know, army jackets, long hair, and holes in our jeans, and
mm-hmm.
things were very casual, and it was fun. I'm not saying it's not fun now. It is fun, but it's in a different way. And I, you know, don't like to get too nostalgic about that period because, you know, I like to look forward, I think, generally. But it was a lot of fun. It was just a lot of fun. It was, I don't know, it was just fun.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I think I understand what you're saying, too. Like, the culture, the corporate shift has changed the DC and Marvel so much. And at that time, it was almost like we get to make comics, you know, isn't that cool? And it's like, yeah, that's cool. And let's just do it. And the audience was different too. You know,
sure.
It was still primarily, those comics were being read by kids and teenagers. And I don't think that's the primary audience anymore for comics too, you know, because of the shift in the mentality of how you market them, who's buying them, the cost as well. You know, it's sure. not really accessible. You can't go to that spinner rack at your Five and Dime and buy a stack of comics because they cost $4 each, you know?
Right. And the Five and Dimes are, you know, are don't exist anymore.
Right.
Now, I'm just thinking while you're talking about, you know, the conventions at that time, even before I, you know, broke into Marvel or DC, I would come from Connecticut and, you know, I'd take my portfolio around, try to break in and, you know, do samples and go to conventions and network and meet people. And, you know, I remember meeting Gil Kane, you know, and just to show, you know, the generational difference was, you know, he always worked and walked around. I would always see him, you know, in the offices or wherever, and he'd always have a tie on, you know, mm-hmm. and a jacket. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. You know, I mean, you can really see that this is someone from a different generation. And I think he worked with a shirt and a tie on, you know. I mean, it was very much a part of his era, you know, and as I am very much a part of my era.
We talked to Howard Chaykin last fall.
Oh, boy, I bet you didn't get him off the phone.
He was delightful. Oh, my gosh. That was such a great conversation.
He's great. I know. Howard's great.
But, yeah, he spoke about that same shift. I mean, kind of stepping in between those two generations of mm-hmm. the tie and hat wearing, and then the mm-hmm. kind of looser post hippie transition that came after that. And I think that, like, I really appreciate the reflection that you guys are able to do to give us some perspective, because we tend to do a lot of navel gazing with the 80s and the 90s, and then looking back ourselves at the way that the industry has changed just during our time, but it's such a truncated experience compared to, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s. And so I just think for a relatively young industry, I mean, let's be honest, comics hasn't been around the same way that many, many other, even publishing industries have been around. I think it's fascinating to isolate those different eras, the way that you're describing them, and just see how a small kind of insular community has gone through such rapid change in a short amount of time.
I think you're dead on. Yeah, I think that we have changed a lot. You know, technology obviously has been a big part of that. It is interesting. Our culture has changed. You know, some friend and I were sitting around the other day talking about, you know, how music has changed from, say, the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, to today. Mm. It's amazing when if you study music, the changes that have occurred. You know, it is what it is. It's a lot, you know, I think, was Howard regretting the changes at all?
No, I don't think so. I think he was very, he was hilarious. He was able to talk about it anecdotally and in a very entertaining way, but not be trapped by the nostalgia, sort of like you mentioned, looking forward and appreciating the experiences, but without getting, you know, bogged down by both the memories, but also like the bitterness. I mean, he was very candid about his experiences and what he learned from them. And so I think when we spoke about the development of when we spoke about how corporate aspects of the industry became over the years, I mean, he had a perspective that was colored by his experiences. And I think now feels like he couldn't have made different choices and is very pleased with the choices that he made, but aware of kind of how they were a product of what was going on larger in the industry at the time. No.
You know, Howard and I have occasionally done seminars up at Marvel. I don't know if he touched upon this.
Yeah, he actually did. He talked about doing that.
And we actually talked to Brian Wood a few weeks back, and he mentioned those seminars too, and how amazingly influential and educational they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was extremely nice of him to say, but I appreciate that. But you know what I wanted to say about Howard was simply that, you know, our paths have intersected obviously a lot since, you know, we're the exact same age, and you know, we're doing the same thing. So he lives out on the West Coast, I live on the East Coast, but I really got to know him much better during those seminars, and there's no one in the business like Howard. He is unique and a personality unto himself.
Yes.
And sometimes he suffers from being too candid.
Sure.
But that's only part of his charm, you know. He's great. I really like him a lot.
But also you have I think the both you and Howard must have a different perspective, I think, than a lot of people who have been in the industry or once they get out of it. You know, like you have worked continuously in the comics industry. There's not really a break or, you know, a change. So you've been involved in its change throughout these years. So I think that gives you a very unique perspective, too, on how the visual medium has changed, evolved, and its potential, and how, you know, that visual storytelling, I guess, has gotten refined or not. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but it probably, I can imagine you having a very different kind of perspective than somebody who worked in a particular era and then doesn't work in comics anymore.
I think that's right. I think that I've been, you know, through both luck and design, managed to stay in comics for, you know, my entire life so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you're saying is, you know, is correct. I have a perspective as a result of that. The industry, especially nowadays, and the industry is not exempt from what's happening in our culture or in the world as a whole. Things just go faster these days, and mm-hmm. if you're off the stands for a year, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really got to start all over. And if you're out of the business for a year, you've missed something. Photoshop technology or some development or some, you know, political or business thing that's come along. You really have to make a concerted effort to stay on top of things. And I mean that. You really have to, you can't be passive. You have to be aggressive and assertive and proactive in order to stay viable. And one of the things that I can say that I'd be surprised if Howard didn't touch upon this, because it's something that he and I have spoken about often. You have to, both of us have something in common, and that is that neither one of us was blessed with an innate talent that some people have or some artists have. And I think Howard and I, and Howard would be the first one to tell you, that what we have in common is that we got to where we are by sheer hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Just constant perseverance, not giving up, the ability to continually learn new things and improve.
Right.
And I think that if you look at my body of work, one of the things that I'm most proud of is not any particular job, specifically, but that in general, I feel that I have gotten better as an artist, that I haven't yet plateaued. And, I'm very, very grateful for that. But I think that the key to that, and I think Howard would agree with this, is that you have to work at it. You have to work and you have to really apply your shoulder to the wheel, or whatever the expression is, and put in the sweat and the hours in order to maintain your viability. And the other thing that also that you know, the kids at SVA always ask, well, you know, how do you maintain a career that has length to it? And I think the answer to that is you have to have more than one thing to offer. So you can't just be a penciler, or unless you're, you know, really incredibly good. Or right. In my case, you know, I'm an inker, I'm a penciler, I've colored, I've written. I've been asked at various times to be an editor. And, you know, if you have more than one thing to offer, then you become that much more valuable. My teaching, for instance, you know, doing seminars at Marvel or at DC or wherever, has proven to be another thing that I can offer to this medium. And if you know, the kids these days, I love saying that. if the kids these days think that, you know, you can get by on your charm and, you know, some half-assed portfolio, you're wrong. If for no other reason than the internet has allowed produced a competition unlike any that I have ever seen, because everyone has access to everyone's portfolio in the world.
Right.
And that's a hell of a lot more competitive than when I was getting in the 70s or 80s. That's an amazing amount of talent out there and an amazing amount of competition that you have to be better than. Anyways,
let's talk more about your experience as an educator, because I'm a teacher also, and I think it's really interesting to balance the investment and envy as an artist myself, as a creative individual working with the next generation of artists. I'm curious if you've noticed any trends amongst your students in terms of their strengths and weaknesses as visual storytellers as the years have gone by.
There's always one or two in the class. Generally, my classes are like around 20 students, you know, give or take, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little less. So 10% of the class will or has the capacity to do mainstream comics and will succeed in that. Maybe another 10% has the ability to do indie work and self-publishing. You know, a lot of the 80%, you know, maybe 20%, you know, so we're up to 40%. Another 20% might be able to get work in production or something, you know, in the office, or may decide to write instead of draw. There are trends. I'd be curious to see if you've noticed any trends. But the trend that I've noticed is I think to some degree this is a complicated and much longer conversation, but I think to some degree what's emerged in the last couple of years, specifically in the last 2, 3, 4 years, is a general sense of entitlement amongst the kids these days.
Yeah.
And I don't know, do you agree?
I think, well, what I've noticed is there's a lack of, I don't want to say lack, because that just really makes it sound like everything's falling apart. I think that in general, the confidence in creative problem solving is not where it needs to be. I think thinking outside of the box is such an abnormal approach to creative thinking now that it's almost that you have to start at the beginning with teaching the design process when you're working with people who want to be designers. And it's just it's a bizarre stagnation of something that typically before had been like almost inherent in those types of people. And I've had a lot of conversations about the role of standardized testing and secondary education and blah, blah, blah. And we're just sort of getting kids through school and into post-secondary programs where they haven't learned how creative they can be. So you have to remind them. You have to start with throwing them into situations where they have to think as artists and remind themselves that they can, because of the entitlement factor, they haven't realized that they aren't. You know, they've decided they want to be artists. They've decided they want to be creative designers. Okay, just go do that. Well, there's more to it than that. And that's the kind of dual challenge that I've noticed personally.
I think I agree with you and more. I don't want to say the intelligence level, but the educational level that the kids are at, the 20-year-olds are at these days, it has diminished. It's lower than it was 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, if you do not understand the difference between T-O and T-O-O, then there's something wrong with their educational system.
Right.
Whether it's standardized testing or, you know, I think a lot of it is bad parenting too. I would not in any way, I very much point the finger at a lot of bad parenting and a lot of bad habits that we've picked up in the last 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. But the sense of entitlement that these kids have, not all of them. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not going to condemn an entire generation,
sure.
But I do worry about the entire generation, because, you know, I love this country. I feel I'm very, very invested in this country. I have a perspective, you know, that a foreigner, quote unquote, has. I admire what this country. I'm a political junkie. I think that we have an enormous amount of work to do and an enormous amount of potential to fulfill. But there is something happening in this country where we're not investing in our educational system.
Right.
And we don't know, we have not taught these kids, and I would agree with you, how to think. And as far as art is concerned, or kids who want to be artists, they do not know how to look at things.
Right.
You can look at something, but you don't see it.
Yeah.
And you can see it, but you don't observe it. And you can observe it, but you don't understand it. And there's something happening in the, you know, you may call it problem solving, but there's something happening in this generation that is very detrimental to them and to our country.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's happening as a result of this sense of entitlement, you know, whether it's because, you know, everybody got a trophy just for showing up, or any of the other bad habits or controversial, you know, parenting skills that we've all read about. But as a result of this sense of entitlement, the kids are enormously passive and they just sit there. They're not proactive. They're not assertive. They're not aggressive. They don't understand that the kid next to them is going to succeed because he or she is just that much more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I've had a lot of kids in class succeed, but I've had, you know, just because of the odds, I was at a convention in New York last October, and you know, I ran into a kid that was a student of mine like 20 years ago, almost all the way, you know, back when I started at SV. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm framing."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not that there's anything wrong with framing. God knows there isn't. You know, I'm happy that he's doing that. But that's not what he went to school for.
Right.
And that's not what he wanted to be when he was growing up. And so I feel bad. You know, I wonder, how did we or I or the school not, why were we not able to, you know, help him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tough thing to look at somebody and say, you know, and hear that they're framing, you know. And again, not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just, you know, I feel bad for them.
Like a wasted potential.
Yeah.
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 It's somewhere along the line, someone didn't help him.
Right.
You know, assuming that he could have done this, you know, either his parents or society or the educational system or SVA or myself, somebody, you know, didn't, you know, step up and help this kid. So it's,
if you were starting over now as a young artist, you said you wouldn't have gotten far with your portfolio. Would you still be pursuing art and comics, do you think, if you were just heading out today? Or do you think that it's a more intimidating industry to leap into because of the access to the breadth of amazing work that's available now?
It probably, I mean, I think I would pursue it. It probably would have taken me a little bit longer to get in. I mean, I think of the first 10 years of my career as complete and total experimentation in air quotes, meaning crap. You know, I really did a lot of crap. I had no idea what I was doing. And the remarkable thing is, Marvel allowed me to continue doing that. And part of it was because, you know, there was a certain desperation in terms of getting deadlines done. And by all means, you know, I'm not you know, putting any company or anybody down for this. I find, the people who know even less than artists are usually the editors. Editors come from, through no fault of their own, come from usually a academic English studying literature journalistic background. They don't have a background in art. And, you know, even as little as I knew back in the 70s and 80s, which was astoundingly little, I mean, I knew nothing at all. Editors knew even less, because I at least, you know, did it and sort of had the knowledge of, you know, experiencing and doing it. But, you know, one of our seminars was up at Marvel. I would occasionally do seminars for editorial or with editorial. And one time I gave them homework, which, you know, I just loved doing. Mm-hmm. You should have seen their faces where I told them I was going to give them homework. So, you know, it's a 3-page vignette. I said, listen, guys, I know you don't draw, so you're not going to have to draw. Just tell me the story. That's all it is. Just tell me the story. You know, stick figures. And it's hard. It's hard. You know, as many people as there were in that room, that's how many different versions I got back. Mm. It is incredibly difficult to do this. Incredibly difficult. The only thing, and I'll say this till the day I die, I think, the only thing that I think is more difficult is if you're in sports or, you know, some physical activity like, you know, ballet or something, because your career physically is over. Look at Derek Jeter, you know, it's over at 40 or, mm-hmm. or, you know, if a long career would be, you know, 40. Football players, you know, 30 and you're done.
And the difference is the pay scale a little bit though, too.
Yeah. So a little bit. Yes, I agree. So they, you know, they have that, you know, as a cushion, but this is a very, very difficult thing to do. Storytelling and drawing, you know, you have to, you know, it's more difficult than film. And the old, you know, cliche is, you have to, as a comic book artist, be the director, be the cinematographer, be the costume designer, be the, you know, the background guy, be the lighting guy. You know, you've got to do all of that yourself. And if you're not, you're doing it wrong. You're just doing it wrong. In film, you've got one person or 10 people to do, you know, any one of those things. And that's why it irks me so much when I see kids not understanding the importance of study and work and applying themselves. It really is tragic, I think. I think I wandered off the reservation there a little
no,
bit.
No, that was awesome.
No, that was perfectly, yeah.
That was absolutely fantastic.
Well, let's talk about something maybe a little lighter. kind of curious about what you're reading these days. Like, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning. It seems like you're keeping up with comics reading as well as all the work you're doing. Is there stuff that you're reading these days kind of religiously, or how do you keep up with comics, or do you?
Yeah, absolutely. Every Wednesday I'm at, my local comic shop, Forbidden Planet plug.
Nice.
I pick up the new comics and pick up whatever is happening. I'm definitely reading the stuff that's coming out of Image. I think books that I admire usually fall into the category of it doesn't really matter, who's doing what the characters are. Or what the title is. I'm more interested in the artist, the artist and the writer. I'm enormously impressed with, I can't tell you how impressed I am with a mainstream book like All New X-Men with Stuart Immonen and Brian Michael Bendis. I think it's just incredible, an incredible monthly accomplishment. I couldn't be happier for those two guys and the colorist and the inker and everybody on that book. It's recognizing how difficult it is to do quality work, and even non-quality work is difficult.
Right.
It really is amazing what they're doing. I'll also follow what am I reading lately that I'm just into? I mentioned some books. You mentioned Daredevil. I love Chris Samnee and Mark Waid. I love what they're doing, so I'll always pick up their book.
Are you doing research for Superman? Like, I'm kind of curious. Like, when you're inking somebody's work, do you have to really kind of prepare it all for that, or is it like, how do you? I guess this is a kind of a different question, but when you are inking someone else's style, how do you prepare for that? Like, how does that come about? Somebody like John Romita is very different than, I don't even know, somebody from the past. There are very different styles. And
yeah, I think that, in spite of, I think some of my reputation, which was probably garnered, in those early years when I really didn't understand, what I was doing as an anchor. But I think in spite of a reputation for dominating my penciler, I really try to, at least in the last, 20, 30 years or so. Mm-hmm. God, that sounds so long. But try to, be faithful as much as possible to the pencils. With John, I am preparing. I'm getting the first couple pages this week, and I have been preparing. And one of the ways that I prepare is you can't prepare, too much, because then you lose the spontaneity of it, and the you don't want to repeat yourself. But one of the things that I do is, we've done so much work together that right now on my desk, on my sideboard, are stacks of original pages that John and I have done that I particularly liked, that I thought worked well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at them and I say, okay, this worked well. I'm going to have to try and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, if it's doable, if John approaches it in a similar way and the opportunity presents itself, then I would do that. But I don't know. I haven't seen, the pencils. I haven't seen, what John is doing yet. But in terms of, other people, my philosophy is, always meaning, at least the last 20, 30 years, to try and keep what's best about the pencils and improve the things that might be lacking a little bit. You know, if it's a new penciler, someone that I haven't inked before, or someone that I haven't inked in a while, I will spend time with the pages. We'll go out on dates. We'll have dinner. I'm kidding. But I will, you know, I will look at the pages and I will study them. You know, I'll always make Xeroxes of them. So I have Xeroxes, full-size Xeroxes next to me as I'm inking them. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about certain pencilers is another reason why I make Xeroxes is, you know, if you start on the upper left-hand corner, and you work your way down. Oftentimes, by the time you get to the bottom, your hand smudges the pencils. And so one of my patented techniques is that I start at the bottom. I start inking a page at the bottom and work my way up so that I don't smudge. You know, I'm very invested in keeping as much of the penciler in there as I possibly can. And I do the same thing with my own pencils. You know, I'm penciling and inking a job for DC right now. And, you know, I'll do the same thing. Make Xeroxes, make sure I have, you know, copies of the pencils. Start at the bottom. I use a pencil that smudges easily. So you want to keep, you know, you want to keep the vibrancy or the spontaneity of the pencils in the inks as much as possible. And if there isn't any spontaneity, which sometimes there isn't, you try to introduce a little bit, you know?
Yeah, so that's another question I wanted to ask you. It's that collaboration between the penciler and the inker, and it's sort of the public credit, I guess. You know, it's always the penciler, in my perception, that really is top billing on a book, and an inker doesn't get the same sort of recognition, but from hearing you talk, it's a trade. There's a trade there, you know, that there is you are trying to be faithful to the pencils, but there is still your own art in it.
I don't think that there's any doubt about that. I think that you know, a good ink job can save a bad pencil job.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a bad ink job can kill a good pencil job. There's a lot more to it than the public, I think, understands. I've sort of, in a lot of ways, just thrown in the towel in terms of that argument. You know, I was a little bit more invested in that, in making the case for, you know, the dignity and integrity of inkers everywhere.
Well, and it was that case, and not to cut you off, but it seemed like that was the case for so long with colorists as well. Like, color was never, sure, you know, never even really acknowledged, even though every part of the book, down to the lettering, makes or breaks a book, it seems.
It does. And, it, you know, one of the interesting things about this medium is not only the relationship and connections between, say, writer, penciler, inker, colorist, letterer, editor, all of those connections and relationships, but this medium also is about the deeper you go into it, the more you realize that everything about it is about connections and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about the relationship of panel to panel images. It's about the image. You can, for instance, and allow me to go off on this tangent for a second,
sure,
but you can, for instance, you can do a very successful panel and compose it well and draw it well, and the panel is, you know, terrific. But you can put a panel in front of it, another panel in front of it, or another panel, you know, after it, and that same panel will not work.
Mm-hmm.
So by itself, that panel can work just fine. But if you put another panel preceding or subsequent, that same exact panel, not only will it change the meaning of that panel, but that panel can, because of the relationship to the panel preceding or subsequent or following, can be termed as a failure. So it's about relationships. It's about connections. And, you know, there's spatial connections, there's spatial relationships when you talk about composition. This medium is, you know, one of my pet theories is that this medium is entirely based on relationships and connections. And not the least important are the relationships between writers, pencilers, inkers, colorists, and letterers.
Well, it's such an inherently collaborative
medium. It is.
And yes. So my background is theater, and I talk way too much about the connections that I personally feel between a development of a production for the stage and the development of a production for the page, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the connections between theater and comics are so obvious to me because of the multiple artists, writers on down the line involved in both industries. And yet the same problem exists in both when you talk about who gets the credit. And I guess it's only a problem if the people involved in the production on both sides feel that it's a problem. But when you try to identify a single person or a single couple of people who are responsible for something that is by its very nature the product of tens of people, mm-hmm. it loses a little bit and it becomes like less authentic about the documentation of the process because you're leaving out important players, that the final product wouldn't be what it is if they hadn't had their hand in it. So I think that's really, really interesting.
I think you're correct, and I think that you know, if I may add to that, that there is just a lot of I don't know, you know, maybe this word is a little bit too strong, but there is a lot of let's use another word, unawareness mm-hmm. of who does what and who contributes what,
right?
And even beyond that, who does what and contributes what to a specific project, because sometimes the specific project is the inker has a larger contribution to it mm-hmm. than, say, another project.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of, you know, the word I wanted to avoid was ignorance. There's a lot of, you know, ignorance and unawareness of how this medium actually works. Even the terminology that is used in this medium, you know, who is the one that actually puts in blacks? Is it the penciler or the inker? I read columns and blogs where people don't know the answer to that, and that surprises me. You know, and people should be aware that if it is a complete and finished pencil job, the shadows and the blacks are placed by the pencils, by the penciler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a breakdown job, the penciler does not put in the blacks, so it's the responsibility of the inker to put in blacks and you know, line weight and all of those things. But if it's a pencil, if the credit is, you know, pencils by so-and-so, that means that the penciler put in the blacks and the shadows and you know, basically the job could be shot more or less, I would say, you know, from the pencils. So there's still a lot of ignorance and unawareness. And it's okay, because I understand, you know, there's a learning curve involved,
mm-hmm.
but people should be aware that just because you read something doesn't mean it's true.
Right.
Well, and more so, I mean, it gets more complicated when you bring in the fact that a lot of times these are characters with a history that people, readers, fans, have a sense of ownership over, but yet they don't have any control over that character. So they're reading stories and they're responding to the stories and they're very separate from the production process. So then, you know, sometimes we get some outrage over a story and the people involved in the generation of that story, the writers and the artists and all down the line, and it can get really ugly. I'm curious though, from your side of things, have you had a time as an artist where you maybe weren't outraged, but where you disagreed with the direction that a writer or one of your collaborators was taking a character?
Sure. There have been times when, you know, I've started projects, you know, just as an example, I started projects and, you know, the story changes.
Mm-hmm.
In the act of editing or in the process of, you know, delivering and working on the story, and changes and goes in a direction that I was not pleased with. And, you know, you got to bite the bullet because there are certain things that are above my pay scale and I have no control over. And you're professional and you finish the job.
Right.
I have experienced, you know, late in life, some regret over some of the violence that some of the projects that I've been involved in have conveyed. I'm not a Puritan by any means, but I think that there is a line at a certain point that I think dismemberment is not particularly something that I would like to do again. I felt bad about it. But, you know, you sign on for the job and you realize, okay, you know, on page 18, this character is going to get dismembered. And what are you going to do? It's hard for me to say, okay, I'm not going to ink these pages. Or I'm not going to pencil these pages. But, I think my philosophy about violence has changed through the years. I think it does affect people. Mm. I used to think that it didn't. But I've changed my mind about that. So I'm careful about certain things. I'm trying to be a responsible citizen of the world, you know?
Right.
Things change, and sometimes I don't agree with the direction things go in, and you find another way of there have been times when some of the things that I've had to draw or ink and even ink were against my, let's say, beliefs.
Hmm.
And I would bring it up with the editor. And so far, that opinion or those opinions, you know, have been respected, and things were changed as a result of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or, you know, we found some other way of doing, you know, things.
Got it.
And there's, I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm not one, I don't believe in, you know, a top-down censorship, but I'm not afraid of boundaries. There's a difference. You know, I don't believe in general censorship, but I find that having boundaries makes me more creative.
Mm.
Because if there's something that I really want to say, and if there's something that I really want to show, I'll come up with a much more clever way of doing it with the boundaries than if I had no boundaries at all.
Mm.
And I look for boundaries. I look for challenges. You know, I look for a way to challenge myself and my creativity. How do I tell this story and tell the story the way I want to tell it with these boundaries? And it's a much more interesting way of working than having complete and total freedom. So
thinking outside of the box.
That's right. Right.
So, I mean, there's a reason why the box is part of that analogy, because it does give you the structure and it does then give you something to build out of. So
that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It almost becomes like a device, you know,
mm-hmm.
a storytelling device, or, you know, the best, I think the best artists and the best writers, but I'm, you know, more familiar with artists. The best artists have always been able to think quickly on their feet and, you know, not allow, restrictions or parameters to affect their creativity.
I just want to thank you. This was, wow. We really appreciate the conversation about your work and
your
life in the comics industry over the past several decades. This was awesome. Any last words before we have to wrap up?
Just that I'm, I'm really looking forward to, getting started on Superman for real. I've been away from the monthly grind for a couple of months and I kind of miss it. And, I'm penciling and inking a couple of projects. We've got some, really good stuff, I think, coming up. And, one of the things that the three of us were talking about earlier was digital as opposed to still hand drawn. I have finally acknowledged, by the way, that I stink at Photoshop, and I'm hiring a tutor. I am so proud of myself.
Oh, wow.
I cannot wait. I know it's finally. I've got my Cintiq tablet here, and I just use it to hang clothes, and dry laundry. But I am so excited now. I think I'm finally going to take the, I've been playing around the edges for a while, but I really have to take the plunge in a much more concentrated way. So I'm kind of excited. And I look forward to the next couple of years of just better and better work. And, I think I feel as invested in this medium as I did 30, 40 years ago.
That's wonderful.
Well, thanks. Listen, guys, it was really nice talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us on Comics Therapy on the Couch this week. Thanks to everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local comic shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We'll talk to you next week.
Listen, you guys seem like nice guys. You do. You seem like, good people, like comics. I like comics. Everybody likes comics. But the slavery thing, it's not cool, man. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm glad, that you don't discriminate, that, children, black, white, yellow, purple, that's a color that doesn't exist, so that makes it more racist to say it. But, and I understand the temptation, cheap labor. Having somebody to go get your soda and you don't have to pay them and everything, and just a one-time purchase, kind of like an electric razor, you purchase it once, you don't have to refill the blades. I get it. Slavery's bad. I mean, it's morally wrong, and I'm pretty sure we fought a war over it. So, I mean, I'm convinced you guys must be in, like, Guam or something. So, yeah, just stop the slavery, dudes. Thanks.